panel.
Thank you. Thank you very much. So when Tony asked me to give this colloquium, I gladly accepted, perhaps underestimating a little bit the difficulty. Let's see, this is, I need my glasses, I think. This is it. The difficulties in giving something which would be equally interesting for the experts and for the non-experts. I think at least the historical side of it should be easy to follow for everybody. And in fact, let me start by explaining this very long title, because this will be a kind of a preview of the talk. You see, one thing that gets me quite upset, I think now it happens less and less, but is when I was hearing being said that Veneziano one day did not know what to do, so he opened the book in special functions, he opened it at page 279, and there it was, a beta function. And so he said, well, let's see what we can do with it. And there it came. So I would like actually to tell the true story, which is completely the reverse, because I want to argue that actually nature in the late 60s gave us a lot of hints towards strings, and somehow, if any, we were slow in picking up these hints, and it only took maybe two or three attempts before we picked it up. And then it turned out that those hints were actually red herrings. Okay, so this is the bottom line. So let me start with what I can call an evolving Michelin guide, where we give stars to our understanding of the fundamental forces. Well, back in 67, where I will start my history, I mean, I cannot go as back as I would wish, we knew of four forces, and this is pretty much the situation even today. However, our understanding of the four fundamental forces was quite uneven. So there was one theory, QED, for electromagnetic interaction, which certainly deserved three stars in the Michelin guide. QED was well tested and is still being very well tested. However, the other three forces were not as well understood. For instance, the weak interactions were described by this phenomenological theory of Fermi, and then Cabibbo, and so on, Feynman, Gell-Mann, and it was pretty successful, but one knew, phenomenologically successful, but one did not know how to go beyond what we call the three-level approximation to compute the full quantum corrections because of problems of ultraviolet divergences. And a very similar story goes for gravity, where we had a beautiful, elegant theory, general relativity, which was already well tested as a classical theory. But there, you see, we couldn't even go one step beyond the classical approximation, again, because of severe problems in the ultraviolet. But I think the one which was in the worst shape was a strong interaction. And that's where progress has been particularly important, okay? In the electromagnetic and weak sector, we now have a beautiful unified theory, the so-called electroweak theory of the standard model, which certainly deserves itself the three stars. But I think equally, today we have a very good, if more difficult to solve, but still very much confirmed theory of strong interactions, which is called QCD. And we are in good shape. Now, for gravity, we are still lagging behind. That's where progress has been the slowest. And we still hope that string theory will bring the additional star here. But it's not yet completely clear. So this talk will be about this, lower part of the picture, trying to argue that in trying to solve the strong interaction problem, we ended up, somewhere else and maybe understanding quantum gravity, and if you are an optimist, even trying to combine all interactions into a single theory, which is sometimes called the theory of everything, okay? Being very modest. Okay, so let's start the story around 1967, where, focusing now on the strong interactions, there was obviously no theory at hand. There were just a handful of models which would describe, more or less, different aspects of hadronic physics, of the nuclear world, if you want. Well, what were these gross aspects? They were the fact that strong interactions are short range, so no massless particles, that they conserved a lot of symmetries, more than the other interactions, like parity, charge conjugation, time reversal, isospin, and so on. And there was also one rather interesting aspect of strong interaction physics, unlike the other interactions, that we knew of many metastable states which enjoyed strong interactions, usually called resonances, and they were extending to large values of the angular momentum. So it looked like an ever-increasing zoo, because every now and then a new particle was discovered and was added to the list. So this, I think, explains why we took what today we can say was turned out to be the wrong way, because a quantum field theory approach looked hopeless at the time, okay? There were too many degrees of freedom, because all these particles were there around, and furthermore, you know, their number was increasing all the time. So, I mean, if you write a Lagrangian today, then tomorrow you have to add another field, and the day after tomorrow, yet another field. And high angular momentum quantum field theories are typically non-renormalizable. For instance, gravity, you can say, is non-renormalizable because it contains a spin 2 particles, the graviton. So at that time, an S-matrix approach looked more promising. Now, what is an S-matrix approach? Is something which wants to describe directly what you observe. You send in some state, and you observe some outcoming state, and you have a black box, and you try to determine this black box from some kind of first principles. Now, since I will use this notation later on, let's say that a reaction like this, and you can generalize it to more complicated reaction, has an S channel where the initial state forms something, and a T channel where particles exchange something, okay? Now, in an S-matrix approach, symmetries are easy to implement directly on the S-matrix. Causality, which in quantum field theory is implemented by imposing some equal time commutation relations of the fields, can be put in through some analytic properties of the S-matrix or through dispersion relations. And finally, unitarity, which is the conservation of probability, the fact that total probability should add up to one, provides an interesting nonlinear, but difficult, nonlinear constraint. It is difficult because being nonlinear, it mixes up different matrix elements, S-matrix elements. Now, in order to go on, people had to organize this hadronic zoo, and there were basically two tools. One was group theory, for instance, concepts like isospin or its generalization, SU3 of Gell-Mann and Neyman. By the way, Neyman spoke how long?
Neyman? No, Gell-Mann.
Gell-Mann
spoke for 3.5 hours.
Oh, okay. So I have a good limit. Okay. I didn't understand, but it was very short or very long. So this symmetries connect particles of the same angular momentum. Then people were even trying to combine these internal symmetries with SU2 of angular momentum and getting to classify particles whose spin would differ by, say, a unit of angular momentum. By the way, when I use, I'm sorry, for the non-particle physicist, very often by J, I mean J divided by H bar, okay? Now, and then there was Regge's theory of complex angular momentum, which allowed for the classification of particles of very different angular momentum. angular momenta which would differ by a large amount. And not only that, through the work of Chu and Mandelstam, one understood that this Regge theory could also describe, in another way, high energy collisions. So the behavior of the scattering processes at very high energy. How does that work? Well, if you have this famous Chu-Fraucci plot, in which you put angular momentum on the vertical axis, and say the mass, or let me put rather the square of the mass on the horizontal axis, then in the region of positive m square, which is the physical region, you have trajectories which interpolate when they hit some integer or half integer values of angular momentum, the observed particles. And what was already known at the time is that most, with one exception, these trajectories were fairly straight and fairly parallel, like if they had a universal slope. For instance, I think some particle with spin 11.5 also was known at the time. Now, in a different region, in the region m squared less than zero, the same trajectory would control the high energy, small angle scattering behavior at high energy through a formula which looks roughly like this. If you fix the momentum transfer, which is related to the scattering angle by this relation, you get a power law behavior of the scattering amplitude, where this same alpha has to be computed at a negative value, which is basically minus the momentum transfer square. And the alpha that you have to pick up out of these many alphas is determined by what are the quantum numbers in the T-channel. And there was an exception to this, and this was the vacuum trajectory, namely when the quantum numbers in the T-channel were the same quantum numbers as the vacuum, no charge, no parity, no nothing, then the trajectory turned out to be somewhat flatter than all the others. Now, by the way, for the young people who do string theory, this is why we call alpha prime, okay? Because it's the derivative of alpha with respect to m squared, okay? did we miss a first hint? Okay, why am I saying this? Well, typical trajectories in potential scattering or in quantum field theories of the time don't look at all like what I had in the previous transparency. They tend to grow from some negative integer a little bit up, maybe giving a couple of particles, spin 0, spin 1, reaching some value of order 1, then turning over and then going back to negative values. Instead, this famous alpha prime, which is dj over dm squared, turned out to be pretty constant and universal, and its value was of the order 10 to the minus 13 centimeters per GeV. And if you take the inverse of this, which is 10 to the 13 GeV per centimeter, okay, this has dimensions of a string tension. Okay, no doubt about that. Actually, you don't even need the Planck constant to say that. So maybe we should have said, okay, there is a string tension in the data. We didn't, okay? Now, this brought people to propose what I like to call, as you will see in a moment, for reasons you'll see in a moment, an expensive bootstrap, the one that Chu proposed. And this was based on the following idea. Use the general constraints of symmetry, causality, unitarity, and add to those the constraints of nuclear democracy. Nuclear democracy was the principle that all hadrons lie on Regge trajectories when they are in this region, and all asymptotics is fixed by the same Regge trajectories in the complementary negative m squared region. And, well, will this give a unique S-matrix after you add all these postulates? Well, it looked like a very, very difficult program, but let me say one thing. This S matrix constructed this way knew about Mr. Regge twice, okay? Because of the S channel, where you have these hadrons, which occur at m squared equals zero, and because of the T channel, which felt the same object twice. And at the beginning, there was no reason to doubt that you had to add the effect of this and the effect of this. Because, you know, you just look at how it works in QED, and you just copy from there. Since QED worked very well, there was no reason to doubt it. And, you know, in QED, if you do E plus E minus, you have to consider both the diagrams you annihilate to a gamma, and today we add also a Z, and the diagram in which you exchange a gamma or a Z. And likewise, everybody thought when you do pi plus pi minus collisions, you have to add the contribution of resonances in the S channel and the contribution of the same stuff, or whatever the quantum numbers allow, in the other channel. So that was the expensive bootstrap, but then...
Excuse me.
Yes.
What you mean by a Regge trajectory is just that this alpha or alpha prime is a constant?
In general, a Regge trajectory can be non-linear, can be non-constant. So it will be this function, J as a function of M, that defines a curve, and that is called the Regge trajectory.
What is the assumption if it has any shape?
Okay. If it has any shape, it can have a priori any shape.
What is the restriction?
Okay, no, I mean, this function describes the position of a singularity in complex angular momentum, okay, if you want the definition. So what Regge found is that by considering scattering in a potential scattering problem, if you consider that the various partial waves and you extend angular momentum to be a complex variables, he discovered that there were poles, you know, 1 over j minus alpha. So the Regge trajectory describes the position of these singularities in the angular momentum plane as a function of energy. As you increase the energy, this pole in j moves, and when it goes through an integer, a half integer, that corresponds to a particle.
The assumption was that you could organize...
All particles according to this, and they were nothing.
In relativistic quantum field theory, there's crossing theory. So unlike potential theory, the T-channel itself is a physical scattering process.
That's right. There's this difference.
Which give rise to scattering. The action scattering in one channel corresponds to actual particles.
In the other channel. Okay, so the same Regge trajectory describes both processes, whereas in potential scattering you can only look at one. Okay, so then came this news from Caltech. I remember I was a student at the Erich Summer School, and Gell-Mann was talking about other things, I guess, but then he couldn't resist mentioning this result. He had just heard from Dolan, Horner, Schmidt, and he said, well, they found by looking into pion nucleon scattering, it was not this process I will show you, that actually S and T channel descriptions are not really to be added one to the other. They are roughly equivalent, they are complementary, they are dual, okay, in the same sense as you say duality in quantum mechanics, wave particle duality, and so on. Two different ways of describing the same physics, and therefore you shouldn't add them. Okay, if you add the two, you get twice the result that you wish. Now, that gave the so he called it a cheap bootstrap, because you see you get a linear relation. It may be very complicated to impose such a condition, but it is still a linear relation, you know, for an amplitude related to itself. Okay, there is no mixing, for instance, of different amplitudes. Now, this idea actually prompted Harari and Rosner to write duality diagrams, to invent duality diagrams, which here are drawn for the case at hand, the case that Dolan, Horn, and Schmidt were considering, which is pi minus proton goes to pi zero neutron. So they drew this diagram, which at the time was just the mnemonics for quantum numbers, okay? And notice that, you know, you can stretch this diagram in different directions. You can squeeze it this way or squeeze it the other way. And depending on what you do, it looks like, you know, forming an intermediate resonance in pion nucleon scattering or exchanging, say, a raw meson in the other channel. Did we miss a second hint? Maybe. Okay, again, I mean, if you look at this diagram now with with our knowledge now, you can almost see the string ends join and splitting and so on and so forth. Certainly, we did not think of that immediately. And, well, there was also a peculiar way of describing, a way to describe why this vacuum trajectory was particularly, was different from the others, okay, because it had to do with processes in which there was no possibility to exchange these quark lines across. You see, for instance, if you take KP scattering, then the quantum numbers are such that there is no way to annihilate one of these quarks with one of these, of this, okay? So, anyway, this kind of processes look more complicated, and it was around the fall of 97 that we tried to consider a simpler case. So we looked at the reaction, which was looked kind of ideal because it's very symmetric. You see, if you take a process like pi goes to pi omega, it is the same no matter how you look at it. In the channel you look, it's always pi goes to pi omega. It's also very selective in quantum numbers. I mean, you can figure out isospin is fixed, charge conjugation is fixed, angular momentum has to be odd, and so on.
So it was really crucial to pick this process.
It was quite important because that gave the simplest possible reaction in which you would isolate really a certain set of trajectories, actually one, basically, and then you just impose this symmetry relation between the two descriptions. Okay. So
was that physical insight or luck that you chose this reaction?
Well, I mean, we tried to simplify. Okay, we tried to move from the phenomenology. I mean, for once, it paid off to, you know, take the phenomenology which was described by Dolan, Horn, and Schmidt, but say, well, that's too complicated. Let's make a Gedanken experiment, okay? And let's apply this same idea to a reaction which is, you can treat better. Mm-hmm. So we sat down and tried to write down the consistency conditions for having this cheap bootstrap satisfied, and it turned out that it was fairly easy, okay? Well, a posteriori, it took many months, but anyway. And the bootstrap got fulfilled pretty well, provided we included many parallel regio trajectories, precisely the type of structure that the data were suggesting. So this was comforting. Now, the next step was achieved, I guess, by the following, if I can recollect my memory well, by the following steps. Okay, in imposing this bootstrap condition, you use dispersion relations. And you know, when you use dispersion relations, you write things in terms of the imaginary part of the amplitude, and you express the real part in terms of the imaginary part. Now, you had to decide to really look at the full amplitude, not just its imaginary part, because it is the full scattering amplitude which is analytic. So it's a use of analyticity that we all love even these days. Then, since linear trajectory imply narrow resonances, okay, this can be shown, then the amplitude had to have simple poles in the energy. It also had to be crossing symmetric, as David was saying, under interchange of variables, as actually ST and also a third variable, U. And finally, and this was the, if you want, the outcome, if that amplitude had Regge behavior, you would be ensured that the bootstrap would be exactly implemented. This again you can prove by writing down dispersion relations. You can see that if the whole object is Regge behaved, then by writing unsubtracted dispersion relations, it must work. So the importance
means linear
trajectory. That's right, or that the asymptotic behavior is controlled by those trajectories at negative mass square. That means you see that the amplitudes for sufficiently large t would go down fast, and that allows you to write down unsubtracted dispersion relation. Once you have that,
it doesn't require linear trajectory.
No, not linear. Not linear. Sorry, you said linear. Okay, sorry.
The linear trajectory is only required by having infinitely
narrow. Mm-hmm. Yeah, linear. Mm-hmm.
David, could you speak a little louder so people in the back can hear?
Adelstan, who really outlined this program, right, of infinite now resonances and and showed that then you could write things just in terms
of poles. Okay, thank you. Yeah, I mean, this was an important step. I mean, to realize the fact that rather than insisting too much on the Regge behavior, which a posteriori is seen as only as an average, the important thing was to emphasize the narrow resonance. So the fact that you wanted to construct amplitudes which had pole-like singularities. Okay. Starting from the results of the previous work on the bootstrap, and with some trial and error, trying to work out what the full amplitude, the real plus imaginary part, would be, indeed, the simple ratio of Euler gamma functions popped out. Okay, we had already gamma functions in our ansatz. Okay, but okay, they arranged nicely in a symmetric form, and then I think I recalled having seen that ratio somewhere in an undergrad course I had taken in Florence. And then I looked for its name, and I found it. And it's the Euler beta function, which is written in terms of gamma functions this way. And of course, for instance, has the symmetry between x and y, okay?
Yeah,
which is discussed.
You would say a few more words about trial and error.
Yeah, okay. Try and there. So the point was to, but I need the blackboard.
Yes, please.
Can I, okay.
Yeah, we can use the screen. Try all the buttons. Try a different button.
The black one.
Ah, okay. Then I have to also. Doesn't go off.
Yeah,
I have to.
It just went off.
Oh, it went off. Okay, so trial and error. I thought it went off. Okay, I'll use a little piece of blackboard. The point is that what we had found by. Okay, so what we had found by trying to satisfy these bootstrap constraints was mainly a condition on this imaginary part of an amplitude. And the simplest answers that seemed to work was pretty simple, if I remember correctly. It was something like 1 over a gamma function, okay? Let's call it x without being more precise. Okay, and then the other variable y to the x. Something like this, okay? Times some coupling constant, okay? So the point was that this was the imaginary part. So you had to find a function A whose imaginary part asymptotically goes like this. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, it also had to have poles, okay? poles in X and poles in Y. So what is something? Okay. So you can start this way. You can start by saying, if I have minus y, let me try to remember. Is it like that? Sine pi x. The imaginary part of this is basically this, because taking the imaginary part gets rid of the sine. But then gamma of x times sine is, if I remember correctly, gamma of minus x, okay? Up to a pi, okay? So you get gamma minus x minus y to the x, okay? But now I think I have a minus sign flipped around somewhere, but okay. But then, okay, that's the important thing. Now you say this is not symmetric, and yet the amplitude A, because this is, I made a mess, huh? This is the imaginary of this. Okay, so this is the amplitude. This is supposedly the amplitude whose imaginary part is correct. But now, this amplitude is supposed to have singularities in X and singularities in Y at the same time. But it's very asymmetric. It should be symmetric in X and Y. So you have to invent a modification of this factor so that it gives the symmetry, and at the same time, it goes asymptotically for large y like this. And this is simply gamma of minus y. So instead of this factor, you put a gamma of minus y divided by gamma of minus y minus x. This has the property of going. And now you are symmetric, you have the right asymptotic behavior, and so on and so forth. So this is, I think this was about how it worked. Okay. Let's continue. So then, okay. I remember that, okay, when this came out, I was very busy packing because of a boat trip to Venice. You see, to my origins, back to the origins. I had to leave for, I mean, this is the explanation why I had to leave, but I let you read it. Now, so I didn't have much time before boarding the boat, but on the boat I had some relaxing few days, and so I could figure out several interesting properties of that beta function. Then I arrived at CERN. I was on my way to my first postdoc at MIT, and I started to discuss this idea with colleagues at CERN. But the reactions were quite mixed. I mean, I don't think it was a very unanimous thing. But so I was hesitating whether to publish or not this result. And then I remember I went to give a talk in Torino, where Sergio Fubini was. And by the way, Sergio Fubini is the one who had invited me to join him at MIT. And his advice was very clear. He said, oh no, this is very nice. I mean, you should publish it immediately. And then we'll discuss when you arrive at MIT in September. So this is how it went. Sorry. I submitted the paper to Nuovo Cimento, then took a month off. And then in beginning of September, I went to the Rochester conference in Vienna. And to my amazement, everybody knew about this this little paper, and everybody was talking about it. Okay. So then I arrived at MIT, and then mainly with Sergio Fubini, we started to work on this. And many, not so many, but several other groups were working in the US and in Europe on this, and on generalization of this beta function. And the interesting thing is that more and more consistency and more unexpected properties were popping out, okay, as we tried to dig out the properties of these models. For instance, one interesting result was that the number of states was much more, I mean, the number of resonances that these models actually contained was much more than these naive Regge trajectories would indicate. There was a lot of degeneracy, namely each level was very degenerate, not all of them, but most of them were highly degenerate, so that the spectrum, the number of states would increase exponentially in mass, and this led to the to saying that there was a limiting temperature in string theory, in these dual resonance models, as they were called at the time. We also found that this many states were described in terms of an infinite set of harmonic oscillators, which had quantized frequency, you know, omega n, which was n plus 1 times some fundamental frequency omega 0. Then, okay, underlying symmetries were discovered, vertex operators, Virasoro algebra, which was the precursors, if you want, of conformal field theories. And they allowed for the removal of some negative norm states, which otherwise would make the model inconsistent. Then the Nevers-Schwarz-Ramond model came, which was also the first example, at least in the West, of supersymmetry. And they had the advantage of eliminating one of the bad features of the previous models, which is a tachyon. And finally, there was the construction of consistent loop amplitudes, because you had to go away one at some point from this narrow resonance approximation and introduce widths and corrections. And this was the first time that people discovered that string theory liked to live in more than four dimensions, by the way. Anyway, there were mixed feelings building up at the beginning of the 70s, because on one hand, you had a beautiful mathematical structure, theoretically consistent, and also a very rigid, constrained, and predictive framework, which is always very nice theoretically. And finally, the third hint from nature, the fact that there was this infinite set of harmonic oscillators with all multiple frequencies, was finally picked up by people like Nambu, Lenny Susskind, Holger Nielsen, and they so that people, you know, discovered the underlying string and elevated, if you want, something which was called a model to a theory. So you went from dual resonance model to string theory. However, you know, there were many roadblocks, and the theory was very rigid, very inflexible. So you could not. So I put here all question marks. At least, you know, there were no-go theorems, but it looked very hard, so I put impossible question mark, for instance, to get rid of massless states. Remember I said from the very beginning, one of the properties of strong interactions is short range. Here we had massless states of spin up to 2. Impossible to be consistent in 3 plus 1. It looked impossible to really go to our four-dimensional space-time. Impossible to go off-shell, okay? This, you know, still with us to a large extent today. Impossible to add the point-like interactions that experiments at SLAC, at MIT, were seeing in the data. So all these things seem to be stumbling blocks in confronting a beautiful mathematical theory. And then, finally, the competition came from quantum field theory, because QCD came about, and it had its proven ultraviolet freedom, or asymptotic freedom, explaining, therefore, the deep inelastic data. It had this conjectured infrared slavery, that is, confinement. And therefore, you see, it was not the kind of quantum field theory that we had discarded at the very beginning. It was a very, very non-trivial field theory in which the degrees of freedom in the Lagrangian are not the degrees of freedom you actually see experimentally. So very, very non-trivial. So as to myself, I kept trying still doing some phenomenology with string theory using its topological structure, the fact that you know, you have this duality diagrams, if you want, which are described in a topological way. You know, there are planar diagrams, non-planar diagrams of different type, and so on. So, for instance, I was trying to understand the relation between the normal Regger trajectories and the Pomeron as a difference between a planar and non-planar diagram. And I finally, personally, gave up on this when Toft showed that even the topology came out of QCD, which at first, you know, was not clear. I was playing with these ideas without having the smart idea of the 1 over n expansion, and Toft showed that indeed in QCD, provided you generalize it to a color SUN theory and you do a 1 over n expansion.
74.
Yeah.
So is that when you gave up, was that when any of the other people also gave up?
I don't know. Some people gave up before. Maybe I was one of the last. I mean, maybe I was particularly attached.
74, 76, 74, right?
70, I think Toft was 74.
74 was early.
To give up?
Yeah.
Really? Oh, you consider it early? No, I thought it was very late. I should have given up earlier. Well, in 74, I was still working a little bit on this, I mean, until 75 and so on. And then, finally, in 76, I started to work on large N expansion in QCD. So, and in fact, you know, it's very nice because in large N QCD, the Harari-Rosner duality diagrams take up a precise meaning. They are the Feynman diagrams bounded by real quark propagators and filled with a fishnet of gluons. They give the narrow resonance approximation which we have been using all the time. At subleading order, the non-planar diagram should give glue ball, you know, bound states which are just made of glue. Presumably, they also should give the Pomeron as a trajectory they lie on. And by the way, in QCD, this Hagedorn temperature that we have found is nicely reinterpreted as a a deconfining temperature of a phase transition from hadronic matter to quarks and gluons. So it all seems to fall beautifully into place, but I want to emphasize that we still don't know which is the string theory that, you know, the nature was pointing at, deceiving us, okay? So my conclusion is that I hope we'll find out one day. Thank you.
Finished very early, so I'm sure people have some questions.
Surprising.
Yeah. Eshel?
Coming from the other side of the program.
Mm-hmm.
What role gluons play in current string theory?
Gluons?
Yeah.
In current string theory?
Yeah.
And you mean in superstrings?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. You see, this is should be part two of the colloquium. I could go on for another hour, okay? You see, of course, it's paradoxical at first that a theory which failed as a theory of strong interactions, we now pretend that it could be a theory of all interactions. So there is a twist there, of course, and it's well known. And the fact is that there we were talking about strings which had hadronic size, okay, 10 to the minus 13 centimeters. The string tension was this, 10 to the 13 GeV per centimeter. Now, what we are talking about is a completely different order of magnitude. These are strings which whose tension is so much bigger, or their size, their characteristic size is so much smaller. Then we pretend now with these new strings to describe the gluon itself. So the difference is that in those days, if you want, nature pointed our attention towards some effective strings which exist in QCD because of color confinement, quark confinement. Whereas the new strings address themselves, the new string theory address themselves to trying to understand, the very quanta that enter into the theory of QCD. So the quark and the gluons should come out as strings. Now, if you ask me, how in QCD in modern string theory we get gluons, you have to ask, how can string theory give gauge groups like SU3 of color, SU2, U1s, and so on? And there are examples which do that. Unfortunately, there is a big problem in in string theory, which is the problem of degeneracy of solutions. There are many, many solutions, and we still don't have a theoretical criterion to choose one from another. But say, in some models, certainly, gluons are there, and they are described themselves by strings.
If you go from strings to membrane, this can resolve the something that people do.
String theory at the perturbative level doesn't have membranes, but it is believed that if you go at some non-perturbative level, it has extended objects like two-dimensional or even more dimensional objects called membranes. There are various types of them, deep brains and so on. I think that the discovery of brains has only made, for the moment, the problem worse. Namely, there are even more solutions to the configurations that you can imagine. We call them vacua or string theory. So the old string was living in flat, 10-dimensional space-time. But now, we can conceive different string theories which live in different backgrounds. And they all have different properties. Incidentally, one answer to your question is that the existence or rather of gluons in a string theory may depend on what you do with the compactification of the extra six dimensions that you have to dispose of. Okay? You have a total of 9 spatial dimensions. You want to end up with 3 large dimensions, and the other 6 must be very small, otherwise we would see them. Okay? And there are many, many ways of arranging that compactification. Depending on the way you do it, you may get different gauge groups at the end. You may get different number of families. Typically, I don't know, the number of families are related to some topological numbers associated with this compactified space. But there is a lot of arbitrariness. So even, if you ask me, is the up quark coming out of string theory? Well, it depends whether you have the right compactification and the right model.
I did not hear about the fact that you had this idea. I never heard of this story before, that you had the idea on a boat trip. And that's interesting, because many physics...
No, the idea, it was there before, but I worked it out.
But many physics discoveries were made on boat trips, right? Because of the long boredom and the long time.
You don't know what to do. But I didn't have a mathematical library on the boat, so it was not.
I want to ask about the usage. There's this thing called the Veneziano model.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we're in our program, we've come into contact with biologists, and for biologists, a model is a mouse, for instance. That's a model. It's the system that they study. But physicists are used to more precise language, and and in particular, a model is something like an Ising model or a Lie model or whatever. Mm-hmm. It's something that you can solve. Mm-hmm. But it's misused a lot. And
yeah,
I wonder whether you were, in the interests of time, you didn't tell us about the Veneziano model, or whether it is a slight corruption of usage. What you described to us, I would have called some phenomenological assumption about
A formula
or a phenomenology, but not a model. Something that is just an abuse of language?
Well, look,
or is there a?
I think there is. First of all, I think there is an abuse of language in our field. So, for instance, why do we call the standard model a model?
Yes.
Okay? It looks like a good theory. It looks like a very good theory.
At least it used to be a model and then it graduated to a theory.
And people still call it.
It's a model in the sense that it starts out with an assumption about some Lagrangian that you're supposed to solve.
But this was
no. Well.
this was perhaps a unique case in history, speaking of history, that it didn't proceed that way. What Gabriele wrote down was a function,
right,
which satisfied certain criteria,
right.
But that's all. And what
there is no model for which this is the right answer.
No. The program of writing down an S matrix.
Yeah.
If you see the philosophy.
So it's a model for the S matrix. You can say.
Like writing down a model for the answer. Right. Except that it was obviously not the answer because of all these polls. Inconsistent.
But that's imprecise language.
No, it was the philosophy of the time. People thought you can write down.
People tried to write down the answer.
Yeah. That's what I would call phenomena. I'm just talking about usage at this stage.
So in a sense, you might call this a Veneziano
formula.
Veneziano formula
or conjecture.
What you call? I understand what you say. I think I understand what you say. What you say is that the model is more usually used in other fields, at least, as a schematization of the problem that you can then solve. So you make a model of it, like the Ising model, for example. So this is, I agree with you, it's not the same acceptance of the word, but I think it has become a bit the norm in our field to call a model. You see, the standard model is the same, there are many.
No, it isn't the same because it was a model. It was just some Lagrange.
It was like an answer.
It's sort of like the loaf and wave function where you write down the answer. But also, in those days, in some sense, there's an ideology in our field that there were no models. There were only amplitudes.
It's the loaf and wave function.
When the dual resonance model.
Yeah, it was called the dual resonance model.
It wasn't just this formula, as Gabriela said. Immediately, people started generalizing.
To generalize, so you had the full.
4-point function to 5, 6, 7 ad infinitum.
But these are all phenomena.
And each one of those, and originally had a name, was so-and-so, whatever. And so in the end, they were all. Then there was a procedure. Not to regard this as the tree approximation of some S matrix and to unitarize it. And at that point, it became a model. You knew what it meant to construct it iteratively.
It's also an acceptable word because, I mean, a model is, I mean, all we do is always say a model of reality, right? We try to fit some data, having something on which we compute things, and in that sense, it was a constructive way to compute experimental quantities, a model of reality.
In the modern picture of a superstring, are there also bubbles that can have different gauge outside and inside,
I think this is a much debated issue. I mean, whether you mean whether different parts of your space could have different realization of the theory. Is that what you are asking?
No, talking about today, you mentioned that there are non-linearly. They also get members.
Yes.
You have also structure of bubbles connected with strings.
You have membranes connected with strings. We certainly have membranes connected with strings. I don't know, and these are precisely these D brains, okay? You have, say, some, say, two-dimensional objects, just to make life simple, and there are strings which join the two. They can curl up in some extra dimension. They're usually compactified in some dimension. So this can be compact object, finite volume. I draw it like this, but think of them as some compact object. And there are strings which go from one of these to another. And by the way, this is also a way to understand spontaneous symmetry breaking, Okay, there is this interesting analogy between the Higgs phenomenon and the separation of these brains. You see, if you separate two brains, then the string which connects one brain to the other cannot have zero length. And because of the string tension, it cannot have zero mass. And this is the way we can understand in this language how, say, a W meson or a Z meson picks up a mass. But certainly there are full gauge theories which are constructed out of these brains or higher dimensional objects. Yeah.
Jim,
You gave this beautiful talk in which you started from S matrix theory, right? The principles of unitarity, allotricity, and crossing. Mm-hmm. I presume that if string theory is ever completely formulated, it will be consistent with those principles. Mm-hmm. To what extent might it be true that the final formulation is unique, so that we could actually go back to unitarity, analyticity, and crossing?
Oh, that string theory would be unique, you mean?
Yeah.
And derivable from this? I don't have an answer to that. I mean, it shouldn't.
We know it's not true that there are pure yet non-abelian gauge theory in four dimensions exists for any rank gauge group, we believe.
Mm-hmm.
Lots of representations in the matter. So there's certainly
no, but the question is if no, but I thought your point was if you're more ambitious and you want a theory which includes gravity, everything inside, then whether for that global theory of all interactions there would be a unique.
That's more than those three.
All right.
Oh, okay, okay, okay. No, of course. No, I interpreted it in that way. Then it's a big question that, for instance, Lenny and David have been debating. Is there a unique superstring vacuum or theory which predicts all numbers and all quantities, or is there a multitude of possibilities? You see, when I answer to you saying that there is this problem of degeneracy, one is really talking about what we know so far by doing some perturbation theory. And we find that there are all these vacuums. But for instance, there are different string theories corresponding to different values of the coupling constant. The coupling constant is a field, it's not a number, and therefore to have a continuum of possible values for the coupling constant means, in the theory, to have a massless field. This massless field typically gives long-range interactions which are not seen. So the hope is that by being smarter, or by solving the theory at some better level, non-perturbative level, this flat direction, this possibility of moving in field space freely without any energy cost, will be removed. And that, presumably, may one day fix the coupling constant. For instance, alpha, the fine structure constant, in principle, could be a prediction of the theory, could come out of the theory. So this is one example of what could mean to end up with a unique thing, but it's only one small example.
But I think we have a lot of evidence for duality that the answer to Jim's question is no, that there are continuum of completely consistent quantum theories of gravity and having S matrix that satisfies crossing unitarity and so on. None of them look anything like the real world, but they satisfy all these mathematical problems.
Yeah, if you take very supersymmetric, that's true.
They have systematic supersymmetry, and you can use that to prove all kinds of theorems about their stability and so on. And all of these duality relations that suggest that they obey these principles, not just perturbatively in the string expansion.
That's right.
I was just hoping that you could go home again.
Yeah.
We have a question here.
So you started with the hypothesis of unitarity and locality, and then that you need to have some linear measure trajectory, and then you find the amplitude as the functional form of beta. Then
No, I think there was I went maybe a little too fast there. That was the expensive bootstrap with unitarity, okay? The difficult one, because it involves a non-linear relation. What the beta function ansatz does, it satisfies the linear bootstrap condition of duality, namely the S-channel being equal to the T-channel description. That can be implemented in an exact way through the beta function. Then the problem of how you do implement unitarity then becomes more like a la field theory. You see, if you have a quantum field theory and you write down the three-level approximation, that is not unitary. You have to include loop corrections. And the same, in principle, can be done here. So unitarity is no longer put in as an input to the bootstrap. The bootstrap is solved neglecting unitarity for the moment, and then you go on.
So the fact that actually the correct description of stronger forces is given by Giussini does imply that it was this linearity that was wrong.
Yeah, I mean, QCD in this large n limit, for instance, would reproduce presumably all these relations very well. But we still don't know what that string theory is, because you see, QCD presumably gives effective strings with some thickness, you see? And so maybe the superstring description will only become accurate if you go to very long elongated strings and so on. So this is presumably the difference, and the QCD string is presumably much more difficult to unravel than this object, because it's an effective string theory. So if you want, it goes in the direction of saying that maybe physics gets simpler and simpler as you go to shorter and shorter distances, okay? As you go to human molecules or chemistry and so on, it becomes, the effective degrees of freedom become very complicated. When you go to the QCD scale, they become simpler, but still these strings are effective strings with thickness and complicated properties. As you go deeper and deeper, shorter and shorter distances, maybe they become really elementary fundamental strings that we know how to describe. That doesn't mean that all phenomena can be reduced very easily to these fundamental objects. We know very well that in physics, there are coherent phenomena which are very complicated and complex, and it's very hard to derive them from first principle.
One thing that really struck me historically is that, you know, these days with the internet and so on, emails, people don't realize this, but a lot of the history of physics, it's almost by accident that Gell-Mann happened to go to LHA, and otherwise, very few Americans have heard of this.
This idea of framework scenario that has been going on in the literature of having fields attached to this brain, something living in the brain, is it a general feature of string theory, or is it a very particular model in string theory?
I would say it's yet one particular realization of our world. There are basically two scenarios on the market. I mean, one is to say we live in the whole of space-time, except that some of the dimensions are small and compactified. This was the traditional point of view. If you do that, then you end up with the statement that the size of these extra dimensions has to be very small, basically Planckian size, okay? The other possibility, which has been proposed a few years ago, is that actually many, but not all, the particles or we are made of or that we interact with are confined to a brain, which is a submanifold of the full space, and only, for instance, gravity travels everywhere in space. This allows for some interesting possibilities, like
from a classical point of view.
What do you mean classical?
What you're saying is that the idea of confining finding the fields there. I don't know if what you're saying is just classical. I mean, I suppose they're there, but I'm asking if there's a, you know, no mechanism to refine them there.
No, there is. I mean, this deep brains and these D strings are precisely, you see, as Polchinski has shown, okay, there are two ways to quantize a string. So this is a full quantum phenomenon, okay? As we know from the standard textbooks, you can impose Neumann or Dirichlet boundary conditions.
Professor Banks wants to say
something. On this? If you impose Dirichlet boundary conditions, that means the endpoints are kept fixed, okay? Now you can choose to have Dirichlet boundary conditions only in some directions of space, and that allows the end of the string to move around. Now remember, in the QCD string, what was sitting at the end of the, maybe I didn't show it, but it was quite obvious, what was sitting at the end of the string were the quarks. The quarks carry the quantum number. So if the end of a string lie on a lower dimensional hypersurface, that means that, you know, quarks will be confined there, and exactly, I would say. Now, the only way they can do something is that, you know, if you have an open string whose two ends are like this, but then the two ends coalesce, then this can emit a closed string in the bulk. And that would be the phenomenon of emission of gravitons from the brain into the bulk.
If you have an open string in the bulk, or it has two
ends? Not all strings, but if you have in your theory these Dirichlet strings, then they will have this property of ending on a brain.
Non-abelian gauge theory always arises in string theory from singularities that have some codimension. And so it's always true that when you get a non-abelian gauge group in a geometrical picture, it's lying on a lower dimensional submanifold, lives on a lower dimensional submanifold of the full space-time manifold. Now, that's a manifold of 10 or 11 dimensions, so it can fill up all of our world, right? It's always got some codimension. The question is how large that transfer space is, but if in the geometrical picture, not a building gauge theory, it always lives on the lower dimension.
Well, there are no further questions. Let's thank the speaker.